Tom Woods Show, episode 1434.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy the Tom Woods Show, it's time to go to the next level. And next level, Tom Woods, is libertyclassroom.com. This is where my friends and I teach all the stuff you did not get in your conventional education, history, economics, and more, the way it ought to be taught, with all the content they left out or distorted. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. All right, let's see. Before we get started here, I want to make sure you listened to the last two episodes of the show. If you didn't listen to those, I want you to stop this one and go back and listen to those. 1433, 1432. The episode with Gary Chartier about his book on business ethics was just great. That's such a great and important book, and it's so well done. You got to listen to that one. Then 1433 about this whole nonsense about the Russians. I mean, you can't, who believes these things? The Russians influencing the 2008 Ron Paul presidential campaign. Could you imagine anybody influencing Ron Paul? Could you imagine that? I mean, Ronald Reagan couldn't twist the guy's arm, try as he might. You think some creep spook from Russia? It's just ridiculous. So you got to listen to those because those are really good. Now, let me pause for a minute while you go do that. All right, now you're back. Okay, good. You're ready for episode 1434. In today's episode, I'm going to talk about some themes raised in an article I just read from Nathan J. Robinson, who is the editor of Current Affairs. He has an article, a 2019 article, Why Taxation is Neither Theft Nor Slavery. And I'm going to give you some, let's say, a few considerations for your intellectual pleasure, let's say. What I want to tell you about, though, in particular about this week, is that this week, and I'm speaking to you now on June 24th, 2019, is the week of the first Democratic presidential debates of the 2020 election cycle. And as you may know, they're splitting those debates up between the over the course of two nights because the number of candidates is so unwieldy. So there's one on Wednesday night, one on Thursday night. And as you will recall from 2016, Lou Rockwell and I did debate commentaries on all the Republican debates of that year. And indeed, the debates for the general election, we also covered those. And those were some of my most downloaded, listened to, and commented on episodes of all time. So Lou is coming back to the Tom Woods Show, as, which you would know if you were a subscriber to the Tom Woods newsletter. I've mentioned this in there. He is indeed coming back. We are going to talk about the Democrats later this week. But I felt like it's too much to ask of any one person to make that person watch, you know, 4 hours of Democratic debates and then take notes on all of them and come on and talk. So for the second of those debates, I'm going to have a, let's say, a mystery guest right now. You may or may not know this person. He's been a guest before. He's very knowledgeable about politics, and I'll talk to him about the second of the two debates. There's a possibility that that second episode may not get published until Saturday or even a little bit later. It's time sensitive. The debate is taking place Thursday night, and the only opportunity I have to do that episode is Friday afternoon, which is really going to make life difficult on my little Tom Woods team. So just rest assured we are doing everything we can to get that episode out to you in a timely fashion. But we are covering the debate episodes. That is the point. All right. Oh, and by the way, don't miss tomorrow's episode either, because that's going to be great, because we're taking apart an article in the Washington Post that, oh my gosh, this thing so needs to be taken apart. And Peter Klein, who is a great taker-aparter, is coming on here and doing it with me. All right, let's jump into this article. I'm not going to go through every single point. Some of it would be redundant because I have covered this stuff. Like, for example, there's some arguments in here about the social contract, and I do want to link, in fact, let me write this down right now. On the show notes page for 1434, I'm going to link to a relatively recent episode I did on the social contract arguments, and I think this is the best episode I've done on that, and that will help you address those. You do hear that an awful lot, it's true. But I'm going to answer the points that I just think are the most worth talking about. So the gist of it is he can't believe there's anybody who is so unreasonable as to compare taxation with an institution as vile as slavery or something as morally objectionable as theft. And then he goes and shows what the differences between these things are. Well, I don't think anybody is saying I would rather be a slave on a plantation in 1847 than an American living pretty much anywhere in 2019. I don't think there's anybody saying that. That's not what these sorts of arguments are about. The point of a philosophical argument is to help you get to the essence of things that may appear to be dissimilar and that may have accidental properties that are indeed quite dissimilar. The point is, in the nature of the thing, not the outward trappings, but is there something similar in the nature of the thing? It's not to say that a wealthy person who has to pay taxes in 2019 is just as miserable as a slave in 1847. Is there something similar at the heart of it? It does not mean that they're identical or that both situations are equally unenviable. It's to help us understand. That's why we have philosophy, is to help us understand things at the most fundamental level when we get to the real substance of what a thing is. Now, in my book Rollback from 2011, I took the argument of Robert Nozick, which is raised in this article disparagingly, but it is raised and it is at least acknowledged, which is something, Nozick was a Harvard philosopher who wrote many, many things. The most significant from our point of view is almost surely his book Anarchy, State, and Utopia from 1974. And in my book Rollback, I summarized the argument that Nozick makes in that, well, one of the arguments Nozick makes in that book that's sometimes referred to as the tale of the slave. And I'm going to read that to you now. Some of you may know this, but I bet not everybody. And I want you to get that this is an example of what I'm talking about an argument that is made to help you understand the nature of a thing. Now, this story is going to move through 9 stages, and Nozick is inviting you to consider yourself as the slave in the story. So first, you are a slave at the mercy of a brutal master who forces you to work for his purposes and beats you arbitrarily. Second, the master decides to beat you only for breaking the rules and even grants you some free time. Third, you are part of a group of slaves subject to this master. He decides, on grounds acceptable to everyone, how goods should be allocated among you all. Fourth, the master requires his slaves to work only 3 days per week, granting them the other 4 days off. They can do as they wish during their free time. Fifth, the master now allows the slaves to work wherever they wish. His main caveat is that they must send him 3/7 of their wages, corresponding to the 3 days worth of work they once had to do on his land every week. In an emergency, he can force them to do his bidding once again, and he retains the power to alter the fraction of their wages to which he lays claim. Sixth, the master grants all 10,000 of his slaves, except you, the right to vote. They can decide among themselves how much of their and your earnings to take and what outlets to fund with the money. They can decide what you are and are not allowed to do. We can suppose for the sake of argument that the master irrevocably grants this right to the 10,000 slaves. You now have 10,000 masters, or a single 10,000-headed master. Seventh, you are granted the freedom to try to persuade the 10,000 to exercise their vast powers in a particular way. You still do not have the right to vote, but you can try to influence those who do. Eighth, the 10,000 grant you the right to vote, but only to break a tie. You write down your vote, and if a tie should occur, they open it and record it. No tie has ever occurred. Ninth, you are granted the right to vote, but functionally it simply means, as in the eighth stage, that in case of a tie, which has never occurred, your vote carries the issue. Nozick's question is this: at what stage between 1 and 9 did this become something other than the tale of a slave? Now, I don't know about you, but I find that pretty compelling. Because obviously, he's leaving us at the end with a scenario which is pretty much what we find ourselves in today. And his point is the central principle that there's an outside directing force that in one way or another lays claim to some of the fruits of your labor. His point clearly is, this means that there is still something at the heart of this system that is similar to what existed in the other system. At no time, obviously, at any point of that, is he saying all of these stages are equally desirable, or all of them are interchangeable, or we'd all rather live at stage one than stage nine. He's not saying anything like that. So there's no reason to caricature what he's saying. He's doing what a philosopher does and identifying commonalities, finding out whether the substance of something is identical to the substance of something else. So then Robinson goes on to say, I could make you a list of about 400 ways in which being taxed is not like slavery. For one thing, you get to vote on tax policy. And he puts an exclamation mark after that. So I almost thought it was a joke. I mean, you don't use exclamation marks that much, so I thought he must be joking. Oh, you get to vote on tax policy. Oh, well, that makes it different, doesn't it? That makes everything so different that you get to vote. It's funny, Nozick already addresses that argument. He says, even if you do have the right to vote, functionally, that only means that in case of a tie, which has never occurred, your vote matters. Otherwise, it doesn't. So in what way is this any kind of safeguard, particularly when you have people like Robinson getting the Democratic majorities all riled up against you, all riled up in favor of going over and confiscating what you own? And of course, this also takes for granted that there is some group of people known as the state who just have magical rights that are bestowed on them, magical powers to interfere with people's property and lives, powers that nobody else has. And the way Robinson handles this is to, with a wave of his hand, say, well, I don't really like philosophical arguments because I'm a utilitarian. I just want what works. So, you know, I really don't care what you pointy heads are talking about over there. I just care about practicality and what works. All right, well, we're all thrilled to have heard this particular bit of information about Nathan J. Robinson, but I don't think that particular bit of information suffices to force me to stop having philosophical arguments. I mean, I think that's how you get to the bottom of things, how you understand things. And simply because he doesn't like them, I don't think that's an argument that overthrows everything that's being said here. Well, we've made a lot of logical claims, but, you know, Nathan Robinson doesn't like those. So we're going to have to do this a whole different way. I'm not persuaded by that. You get to vote on tax policy. Big deal. Your vote doesn't matter, and you're overwhelmed by people who want to take your stuff. So big deal. All right, then Robinson doesn't like Lockean homesteading theory. John Locke, of course, the philosopher who theorized about how you would take a world in which everything is owned in common and withdraw some portion of it for your own use. Now, Rothbard looked at it as the world is completely unowned, as opposed to it begins owned in common. But anyway, that's the starting premise for Locke. And he has this argument about homesteading. He uses a sort of unfortunate phrase, you mix your labor with the previously unowned resource, and then it becomes yours. And Robinson doesn't like this, and he makes the sort of classic arguments against it. If I open a can of soup into the ocean, spreading the soup far and wide, do I own the ocean? Now, we've already addressed this on this show, because really what Locke was driving at was that in mixing your labor, you are making the thing you're mixing it with more useful, more serviceable, okay, more useful to mankind, basically, in one way or another. And obviously, opening a can of soup in the ocean doesn't do that, whereas cultivating a field does. So that's more what he has in mind with mixing his labor. It's not just you go out into the ocean with a can of tomato soup and you pour it in there, and now you've mixed your labor with the ocean, you own the ocean. I mean, this is just juvenile. He also wants to make clear to us that taxation is not theft either. And he says, now, first of all, why don't I just read him? Well, first, I want us to be careful. Deciding whether taxation is theft doesn't actually tell us whether taxation is justified. The word theft is used to imply that taxation is illegitimate, but it could be that taxation is both a kind of theft and is completely acceptable. And then he gives the example of the main character in Les Miserables, you know, who steals a loaf of bread. And he says, look, this was not stealing, but it was morally fine, because there are some situations in which a moral claim can trump property rights. Now, all right, well, you could go back and say, look, in that case, the issue would be, first of all, in my case, let's say I were in that situation, as soon as I became able to make reparation, I would give that guy a loaf of bread back, because I'm not a deadbeat. So I would do that. I would be thinking to myself, I owe this guy, right? I wouldn't be sitting around talking about how entitled I am because I'm poor. I would think, well, when I get back on my feet, I owe that guy something. That'd be the first thing. And I think there would be cases where the question would people really decide to imprison a guy in that situation? You know, but anyway, the point that I would make about this is, if you're going to try to say, as he does, he says, unless you believe private property rights are absolutes, there is no other moral consideration that can override them, then we have to weigh the sanctity of ownership against other factors like people's lives. Well, the problem with this is people's lives is such a vague category that it could mean anything. And it could mean a constant and arbitrary and uncertain series of interferences with private property rights because, well, people's lives. Well, there will always be a case where some people's lives are worse than others, no matter how wealthy the whole society is. Some people's lives will be worse than others. So there will always be people claiming that people who have more stuff than others are not entitled to it. And the other people's need should trump the private property rights of the people who are wealthier. And so then you have a society where you don't know who's going to owe what, when, and on what grounds. And so obviously people just stop acquiring wealth at that point, which wouldn't be good for anybody. But even worse than that is, how would we judge what would be enough for people? Like, as soon as we start redistributing on the grounds that it's morally unacceptable for you to have this and this other person to have this because this person deserves a fulfilled life and deserves a full belly. Well, okay, but what does that look like? I mean, does that mean a Netflix subscription or not? Does a Netflix subscription, is that included in a full life or not? And if so, why? And if not, why not? I mean, this would just be an endless series of arbitrary judgments. Or I pointed this out in a chapter I wrote in a book on Catholic social teaching. I wrote a chapter on the problem of the just wage. And I pointed out that George Stigler in the 1950s, the economist, estimated that you could have a physiologically adequate diet at a cost of $8 per month. Now, these are 1950 prices. If you, over the course of the year, ate the following. Like, you would stay alive if you ate nothing but the following: 370 pounds of wheat flour, 57 cans of evaporated milk, 111 pounds of cabbage, 25 pounds of spinach, and 285 pounds of dried navy beans. That would keep somebody alive perfectly well. Now, are we now going to say, but people are entitled to a more varied diet than that? Okay, how varied? Which foods? And therefore, how much money should they get to buy those? I mean, this would be endless. There would be no way. And then plus there are people, some people have five kids like me. Other people are childless. Still other people are looking after their elderly parents. Are we going to tailor the redistribution to every single nuance and nook and cranny? Also, some people are more ascetic than others. So do they need less? Would they get less redistributed to them? This is just an endless series of impossible calculations. And in fact, here's an interesting line. I don't think, this is Robinson, I don't think respect for the property rights of the wealthy is morally justified. How about that? It's not morally justified. Now, I think I have an episode, let me write all this down, an episode called Hooray for Billionaires. That's your assignment. If you haven't listened to that one, now is the time. I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/1434. That'll address some of that. But he goes on to say, he's talking about Jeff Bezos from Amazon, and he's got a huge net worth, and he could change so many lives if he just gave some of that money away. And so whatever value we might assign to respecting property rights, he says, is outweighed a thousandfold by the needs of others. All right, we could argue about that. We can talk about that. And we can argue about if we are thinking about the needs of others, what are the consequences of expropriating wealthy people? Okay, in the long run, not good for the poor. And I mean, not just either, but also not good for the poor for reasons explained in my Hooray for Billionaires episode. But also the problem with this is, you know, Jeff Bezos looks pretty rich to me, but to a third world person, Nathan J. Robinson looks pretty rich. And Nathan J. Robinson, I mean, you remember all these ads we used to watch, you know, for just 55 cents a day, you can feed 12 people. Why isn't Nathan J. Robinson doing that then? I mean, there's no way he can justify earning 120 grand a year at Current Affairs or whatever they pay him, right? When with no trouble at all, I mean, literally none, Really? I mean, he would not feel the difference in his lifestyle, or at least he could, let's say, he could adjust to a lifestyle that he could certainly live with if he parted with some chunk of that money. And as I say, he looks as rich to them as Jeff Bezos looks to us, and yet he doesn't do it. He doesn't do it. So there's hypocrisy involved. They obviously, at some level, don't really believe this. And then we get the usual argument, and without the state, you couldn't even be acquiring wealth in the first place, so the state has a prior claim on it, because the government, he says, look, property rights are enforced by courts, money is issued by the government, the military protects us. There is no world in which pre-tax income could ever meaningfully belong to its recipients, because without taxes, there is no government, and government is necessary to create the roads, sewers, streetlights, courts, et cetera, that make obtaining the income possible. All right, well, then that's just assertion. I mean, that's just no imagination at all. You don't need government for roads. That's historically clearly the case. Likewise, for these other things, these have been provided by neighborhood associations and all kinds of entrepreneurs, sewers, streetlights, courts. Well, I mean, we have a huge system of arbitration in the U.S. because the government-supplied courts are so slow and expensive. Takes years and years and years and years, and your whole fortune goes down the drain, whereas you can have your case adjudicated in a way that is satisfactory to both parties within 6 months at a fraction of the cost with a private arbitrator. So the reality is the opposite, right? I mean, he wants us to believe in this mythical fairy tale version of government services, but the reality is quite the opposite. But a really good way of thinking about this comes from an article that I'll also link to on the show notes page. Just jotting it down for myself in real time here. And it's an article from, it was a talk given at the Mises University program of the Mises Institute by Roderick Long a bunch of years ago. And he addresses this particular point. I'm just going to read what Roderick says. He says, another popular argument, also used often by the Randians, is that market exchanges presuppose a background of property law. You and I can't be making exchanges of goods for services or money for services or whatever unless there's already a stable background of property law that ensures us the property titles that we have. And because the market, in order to function, presupposes existing background property law, therefore that property law cannot itself be the product of the market. The property law must emerge. They must really think it must emerge out of an infallible robot or something, but I don't know exactly what it emerges from, but somehow it can't emerge from the market. But they're thinking this is sort of like, first, there's this property law, and it's all put in place, and no market transactions are happening. Everyone is just waiting for the whole legal structure to be put in place. And then it's in place, and now we can finally start trading back and forth. It certainly is true that you can't have functioning markets without a functioning legal system. That's true. But it's not as though first the legal system is in place, and then on the last day they finally finish putting the legal system together, then people begin their trading. These things arise together. Legal institutions and economic trade arise together in one and the same place at one and the same time. The legal system is not something independent of the activity it constrains. After all, a legal system, again, is not a robot or a god or something separate from us. The existence of a legal system consists in people obeying it. If everyone ignored the legal system, it would have no power at all. So it's only because people generally go along with it that it survives. The legal system, too, depends on voluntary support. And then he goes on and elaborates on this. But that point that it's not like, for the Robinson view to be true, it really would have to be the case that we're all just standing by, sitting there with goods in our hands, waiting to trade them, just waiting for the grand lawgiver to come down and hand us the legal structure. And then he says, go, and then we start market. Not so. That is not how it works. And then finally, toward the end, we read this generous remark. This is not to say that I believe nobody deserves to have their possessions protected. As I say, I am somewhat flexible and pragmatic in my approach. How magnanimous of him, really. Meaning that I do think people without much wealth should have their things treated as their things and respected. But I don't think people with a lot of wealth should have that same presumption. Okay. In other words, I want to destroy civilization, and I don't even realize it. I think property, aka the right to use force to exclude others, should exist to the extent necessary. And the less you have, the more necessary it is to be able to exclude others from using the things you have. Some socialists draw a distinction between personal possessions and private property. They think people should have their possessions like heirlooms, clothes, a bicycle, respected because these things are for personal use. A factory, on the other hand, is not for personal use and should be held in common by its workers. Now, don't ask me to start putting every object on Earth in one or the other of these categories. And then he goes on from there. All right, so again, instead of a system of predictable rules and principles, we're going to have just a series of constantly changing arbitrary value judgments handed down by utilitarians who are going to decide day to day what seems to satisfy the greatest number of people. And in doing so, they're going to destroy the system that has clearly elevated the standard of living of the greatest number of people. The standard of living of the poor in America has increased by approximately 20 times since the beginning of the 20th century. And that is not because of the welfare state. In fact, I've got some really good stuff on this in a book of essays I edited called Back on the Road to Serfdom. There's some really, really great statistics in there on all this stuff. But this is just the arbitrary approach of people who have no principles. And it's really, really hard to design a society without principles because you can't even have any fundamentals. You just argue about everything. And as I said, you can't even come to definitive conclusions. What would constitute a living wage, for example? You see, it's intractable. And I have an ebook coming out, it's just a matter of days, on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, going through all her different ideas and refuting them. And there's a section in there that goes through and shows why the free market makes wages go up. So if what you care about is this, people's wages going up, then get all the bureaucracy out. Just cut it all. Have as the lowest taxes you could possibly have, all these sorts of things. That's exactly what allows for the capital accumulation that raises wages. Okay, I mean, yeah, you can childishly expropriate the wealthy and go hand their stuff to other people, and they won't even notice it. I'm sure they won't, because I'm sure you won't get addicted to doing that, and you won't keep on doing it to the point where they just give up. I'm sure that won't happen. So watch for that. I'll be announcing that on the show because I'm really happy about that ebook. It really does do some good smashing. Now, what I want to tell you about before I let you go is an engineer who listens to my show. How about that? You know, a lot of smarty pantses listen to this show. And he's got a blog over at chaoticorderly.com where, first of all, he writes about a lot of different topics. So building automation, but also what's a good beginner drone to buy. But then also political stuff like bias in the media or teaching children to read or other matters involving science, religion, politics, and other topics from an engineering and libertarian perspective. He's also got consulting services. You can get drawings, calculations, and reports signed and sealed by him, a professional engineer in the state of Florida, for your mechanical, plumbing, fire protection, and control systems needs. He's got electrical and structural engineers. He's got courses on getting your Florida inspector's license, all sorts of stuff like that. He's got a podcast with a bi-weekly dose of learning involving topics around engineering and construction, such as passing your PE exam, lighting design, getting deposed as an engineering expert witness, and a lot more. So very interesting stuff from a libertarian who is also an engineer. And you can check that out at chaoticorderly.com, linked at tomwoods.com/1434. Get your hosting through me so that you can get some publicity and some free traffic from interested people when I mention you on my show. And how do you get this nice bonus? Before you start your site, go over to tomwoods.com/publicity, get your hosting through me. You get this and other great bonuses that will get you off to an outstanding start. tomwoods.com/publicity is where to go. Make sure you listen in tomorrow. Peter Klein and I are going to smash some bad guys. I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.